60s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, Recording Library volunteers and staff dig into past editions of the National Magazine of Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. Thank you for joining us for this special edition of Texas Monthly Archives. This is the conclusion of our two-part series on Selena. In part one, we altered our usual format to read articles from the current April 2021 edition, which featured Selena on the cover with the theme, Selena at 50. Our volunteer Linda will finish those current articles looking back on Selena and her influence. Following that, we will feature April reading from the December 1995 TM magazine that featured an article on the trial of the person who murdered Selena. And finally, I'll read a shorter article published in Texas Monthly 5 years after Selena's death that followed the emerging trends in the Tejano music industry in the wake of the absence of Selena.
In memoriam. 75,000 mourners signed the condolence book at Selena's 1995 funeral, which was held at Corpus Christi's Convention Center. Then, more than two decades later, 4,500 fans attended her 2017 star unveiling ceremony at the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the largest ever crowd for such an event. Today, 1.2 million people follow Selena's official Instagram account. By contrast, the notorious B.I.G., the superstar rapper who died in 1997 at the age of 24, has 585,000 Instagram followers. S.J. Selena, fashionista. Her striking sense of style celebrated her heritage and pushed it to places it had never gone before. By Frida Garza. You have to start with the right bra. If you start gluing rhinestones onto any old brassiere lying around, you're bound to fail. It won't look the same, says Monica Peralta, a 27-year-old Selena fan from Los Angeles. It really won't. She recommends a sturdy bra from Victoria's Secret or Carnival Creations, one like Selena would have used. To recreate Selena's timeless bejeweled bustiers, Peralta has studied countless photos as well as interviews with the late Tejano singer's family members to glean clues as to how her intricate stage looks came together. On her YouTube channel, which has more than 10,000 followers, Peralta documents her process so that fans can learn how to pay homage to La Reina with meticulously embellished clothing. Over the years, she's delivered tutorials on how to replicate Selena's hair, makeup, statement hats, even the studded leather jacket she wore to the 1994 Tejano Music Awards. The demand for such tips makes clear that, for Selena devotees, there's much more to the singer's appeal than just the music. Today, her songs remain a force for many reasons, none more powerful than her insistence on simultaneously elevating Tejana culture and propelling it into the future. Though she wasn't raised speaking Spanish, early in her career, she sang Tejano songs phonetically in their traditional language. At the same time, she and her band stretched the definition of the genre by singing in English and working disco, R&B, and funk flourishes into her tunes. Yet we rarely talk about how Selena's fashion sensibility evoked a similar tension. I find that Selena's interest in fashion often gets diminished to Oh, she likes glitter, says Maria Garcia, the El Paso County-raised creator of public radio's Anything for Selena podcast. Such an attitude radically undersells how interesting Selena's fashion sense was. As in her music, she refused to accept the binary of staying true to your culture or eschewing it. She chose a different path, embracing her culture while also demanding that it evolve. As a fashion icon, Selena abashedly celebrated her Mexican-American heritage rather than conforming to Eurocentric beauty standards. Few Latino celebrities made much headway in 90s American popular culture, and those who did often dealt with the cruelties of racism. In his autobiography, for instance, Ricky Martin writes about never feeling truly comfortable on the set of General Hospital, where he landed a role in the mid-90s, and coming to believe his Puerto Rican accent sounded horrible. Pop stars in the Mexican entertainment industry, such as Paulina Rubio and Thalia, tended to have fairer skin and lighter hair than Selena did. Both Rubio and Thalia attempted English language crossovers and played up their whiteness to varying degrees. That is what made Selena so different, says Garcia. At the time, you never saw people like that on television, even in Latin American programming. Selena chose to emphasize the shape of her lips with a bright signature red tint. She embraced her perennially frizzy dark brown hair and her body type, which didn't fit a size zero mold. One episode of Anything for Selena is titled Big Butt Politics. Selena's look mirrored the sartorial choices of Texas Mexican-American working-class communities, while simultaneously drawing on the influence of some of her pop star idols, such as Janet Jackson, Madonna, and Whitney Houston. Even when she was reaching for sophisticated styles, she did so on a budget. She wore rhinestones that you could tell were rhinestones, Garcia says, laughing. She wasn't trying to pretend that she was wearing diamonds. To create the splotches on the cow print outfit she wore at a 1991 performance in San Antonio, she used black sequins available for purchase at any craft store. She wore plenty of denim, too, often opting for tight black high-waisted jeans on stage, and occasionally employing more rugged, light-washed varieties. Selena took everyday ranchero references and glammed them up a bit, such as that studded motorcycle jacket that now sits in the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. In Garcia's words, she legitimized these aesthetics, adorning Tejano touchstones and making them into something to be coveted and admired. And while Selena's clothes often bore a handcrafted element, they also had an elegant sheen. At the 1994 Grammys, where she won Best Mexican American Album, she sported red lipstick and a teased updo and wore a shimmering beaded gown. The image of her clutching her Grammy while beaming at the camera cemented her status as a new member of pop music royalty, a point driven home when Whitney Houston, who took home Album of the Year and Record of the Year, graced the stage in a similar getup, a glistening pearl-colored gown paired with a tousled updo. Selena was shaped by the reigning artists of the day, especially the black women whose music she was surrounded by during her childhood. She constantly cited Janet Jackson as an influence, both musically and visually, says Garcia. She often paid homage to Jackson, once introducing a cover of Billie Jean by telling the audience, "This little song is by Janet Jackson's brother." And the first time she donned one of her bustiers on stage, she was covering Jackson's song, "When I Think of You." Martin Gomez, Selena's fashion designer, has said that Diana Ross served as an inspiration for some of the outfits he created for her. This influence is clear in what is arguably Selena's most well-known ensemble, the purple jumpsuit she wore to her last televised concert at the Astrodome in 1995. With its bell bottoms and midriff cut out, Selena was calling back to the 70s, the era she came up in. Her clunky earrings and bold lipstick synced perfectly with the medley of disco songs with which the band started the show. Selena was telling the world something about who she was, a Tejana who felt confident about her roots and one who acknowledged her debt to black forebears. Selena's outfits often challenged her family's conservative standards. Her father and manager, Abraham Quintanilla, frequently objected that her aesthetic choices were too revealing. In the 1997 Selena biopic, Abraham and his wife Marcella squabble about Selena's now famous bustiers. "Es un bra," he shouts in defiance. As a breakout star in a male-dominated genre, Selena always had men weighing in on her image and her career ambitions. When she signed with EMI Latin, the label heads initially rejected her request to record an English-language album, even though José Bayar, the executive who signed her, had presented it to the Quintanillas as a distinct possibility. Marketing decisions fell to men, too. Rubén Zubillos, who designed the cover for her debut album, has said he wanted to play up her natural features. Instead, the bizarre final product featured her walking through what appears to be a desert, done up in an outfit that seems non-specifically exotic. Over the years, as she grew into stardom, Selena seized control of her image and established her own look. By the release of her third album, Entre a Mi Mundo, listeners, as the title suggests, got to enter her world. There on the cover is the Selena we know in a bolero jacket, red lipstick, and gold earrings. Emboldened by how influential her look became, Selena and Gomez launched a fashion line in the early 90s and opened Selena Etc., a boutique with branches in Corpus Christi and San Antonio. Though much of Selena's career had been tethered to her family's dreams, as Garcia notes, fashion offered her an outlet to make something truly her own. The stores no longer exist today, despite an unending public interest in the details of Selena's life and no shortage of fans who seek to recreate her looks. But perhaps that's because parts of her look have since become ubiquitous. People still draw from that visual language, Garcia says. Today, Selena's image is an essential part of American style, something that likely would have seemed unimaginable to her when she was trying to carve out a space for herself in U.S. pop culture. Search Selena Quintanilla on the online marketplace Etsy, and more than 1,000 results for memorabilia, shirts, stickers, keychains, art, still come up, many of them bearing her signature white rose. Celebrities such as Demi Lovato have shown off their Selena Halloween costumes on social media. And these days, Monica Peralta still creates custom bustiers by request for fans who aren't as confident about their home ec skills. If Selena were here, I'm sure she would have hopped on the trend of creating a YouTube channel to talk to fans, says Peralta. If that were the case, I wouldn't have to be doing it myself. Frida Garza is a writer and editor from El Paso who now lives in Brooklyn. Her work has appeared in Guardian US, Jezebel, Elle.com, and more. Beauty Queen. Fans are still eager for Selena-inspired looks, as evidenced by the 37,500 signatures on a 2015 petition to create a MAC cosmetic makeup line in her honor. It became the company's best-selling collaboration of all time, outperforming those branded by contemporary stars such as Lorde and Mariah Carey. SJ.
The Sweet Song of Justice by Joe Nick Potosky. Texas Monthly, December 1995. It took the jury less than 3 hours to find Yolanda Saldivar guilty of murdering Selena. But for 2 weeks in October, all of Texas followed the most sensational trial in years. A behind-the-scenes look at what happened inside the courtroom. "You might not want to sit down here," Douglas Tinker said wearily, holding a glass of white wine. "Man, I haven't won a case in so long." The rotund, balding man with the expansive white beard who recalled both Santa Claus and Ernest Hemingway was slouched in a booth at Buster's Drinkery, an anonymous dive frequented by the lawyers who work nearby at the Harris County Courthouse. It was a Monday afternoon in late October. While the boys at the next table were engrossed in their usual game of gin rummy, a loud party was going on in the streets outside, with honking horns, blaring music, and cheering crowds filling the sidewalks. Most of the several hundred revelers were Hispanic, Mexican-American Texans to be precise, and they had plenty to celebrate. Yolanda Saldivar had just been found guilty of murdering their heroine, Selena. Tinker and his court-appointed co-counsel, Arnold Garcia, a hard-boiled former prosecutor from Jim Wells County, had just finished the thankless task of defending Selena's killer, and they were already second-guessing their defense strategy. Believing they had discredited key prosecution witnesses, they had decided not to ask that the jury consider a lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter, which might have meant a shorter sentence. They had rested their case without calling Abraham Quintanilla Jr., Selena's father, whom they had portrayed as a controlling stage dad and manager, and the catalyst behind the murder. They had decided against putting their client on the stand. The honking of the horns grew more persistent. Tinker had had clients accused of unsavory crimes in his 30 years as a Corpus Christi defense attorney, including George B. Parr, the Duke of Duval County, and a Branch Davidian, but no client had generated the pure hatred that Saldivar did. There had been death threats, and more than once he had spoken of going out in a blaze of bullets, like Marlon Brando in Viva Zapata. "They saw us walk in. They know we're here," Tinker said in a low voice. "Let's have another round." When the evening news came on the television in Buster's, it touted coverage of the Selena trial. Tinker talked back to the tube. "The Selena trial? What about the Yolanda Saldivar trial?" As the celebration outside continued, Tinker smiled at Garcia and raised his glass. "Well," he said, "at least this reduces our chances of getting shot." The same could not be said for Yolanda Saldivar. Ever since that drizzly day in March when she shot Selena, she had been a marked woman. With millions of fans still distraught over Selena's murder, it is debatable whether the 35-year-old Saldivar is safer in prison or out. In life, the 23-year-old Selena Quintanilla Perez was the undisputed queen of Tejano music and an international superstar. In death, she has become bigger than ever. Since the shooting, the legend of the talented, beautiful, smart, clean living vocalist who proved you can assimilate and have your culture too has spread from her hometown of Corpus Christi throughout the world. Street murals in barrios around the state have elevated her to a saint-like status almost equal to that of the Virgin of Guadalupe. More than 600 babies born in Texas between April and September have been named Selena. Her posthumous album, Dreaming of You, debuted at number one on Billboard magazine's album chart in July, making it the second fastest-selling release by a female singer in the history of popular music, after Janet Jackson. Selena's appeal has always been strongest in South Texas, where she lived and worked. And for this reason, State District Judge Mike Westergren moved the trial from Corpus Christi to Houston, where finding a fair jury would be easier. Throughout the trial of State of Texas v. Yolanda Saldivar, Nueces County District Attorney Carlos Valdez kept saying, "This is a simple murder case." The evidence seemed to support him. Immediately following the shooting at the Days Inn Hotel in Corpus Christi on March 31, 1995, Saldivar, the former president of Selena's fan club and close business associate, sat in a pickup in the motel's parking lot for 9.5 hours with a murder weapon pointed at her head, negotiating her surrender to the police. After she gave up, she signed a confession admitting her guilt. This was an open-and-shut case, one that Valdez, a native of Molina, the same humble neighborhood on the southwestern edge of Corpus Christi where Selena had grown up and resided, was determined to win. In his opening statement, Douglas Tinker presented a much darker picture of the events surrounding the murder. Saldivar was Selena's best friend, and she was trusted by the entire Quintanilla family, with, among other evidence, the audio tapes of her negotiations with the police. The defense would prove the shooting was an accident. Also, it would show that the confession she had signed didn't include her claim that the shooting was an accident. Paul Rivera, one of the Corpus police officers who had interrogated her, had left that part out. Texas Ranger Robert Garza would reluctantly testify that he had witnessed Saldivar protesting to Rivera that the written confession he had prepared said nothing about the shooting being an accident. Furthermore, the defense would prove that Saldivar was forced into this confrontation and its unfortunate conclusion by Selena's father, who lived his life through his daughter and was involved in a power struggle with Saldivar, even telling Selena that Saldivar was a lesbian. The defense believed that Abraham did not approve of Selena's expanding her fashion business, with which Saldivar was intimately involved, into Mexico. Selena had had a salon boutique in San Antonio and another in Corpus Christi. Her father, the defense said, thought she was doing so at the expense of the family band. But once the trial got underway, Valdez preempted the defense's blame the father strategy by calling Abraham as the first witness. Quintanilla obliged by speaking affectionately about the family and the band he managed and promoted. He forcefully denied ever threatening Saldivar, calling her a lesbian, or raping her, as she claimed on the hostage audio tapes. His initial response to prosecutors when informed of the rape accusation had been, "Have you ever seen the woman?" The surprise of the trial was Tinker's decision not to cross-examine Quintanilla or recall him later. It meant the defense was not going to pursue the sordid details it had alleged. "He suffered through this," Tinker said after the verdict was announced, explaining what seemed to be an about-face. "He and his family are hurt by what happened, and I decided not to put him through it." Cross-examining Abraham, the defense had concluded, was too risky. It might backfire and stir up sympathy for him. Therefore, the defense stuck to the evidence concerning the accidental shooting claim and the incomplete confession. The jury didn't buy any of it. But before and after the verdict, and the life in prison sentence were handed down, there was much drama at the Harris County Courthouse, involving the aggressive lawyers, the grieving families, the eyewitnesses, and the Selena faithful. Over the course of the 14-day trial, which was the most closely watched murder trial in Texas in years, one thing was certain. Selena's ghost hung over the courtroom and the hundreds of fans keeping vigil outside. The testimony. Eyewitness testimony by family members, boutique employees, gun shop employees, and hospital nurses filled in some blanks about the events leading up to March 31. One revelation was Saldivar's ambivalence about the murder weapon. She bought the Taurus 85-38 caliber double-action revolver on March 11 at a place to shoot in San Antonio, telling the clerk she was an in-home nurse who was getting death threats from family members of a terminally ill patient she cared for. 2 days later, on March 13, the same day she had her lawyer, Richard Garza, draw up a resignation letter to Selena, Saldivar picked up the gun. She returned it on March 15, saying her father had given her a .22 and she no longer needed the Taurus. On March 26, she returned to repurchase the gun. Part of Saldivar's indecisiveness about the gun seemed to be a result of her uncertain employment status throughout March. According to the testimony of Chris Perez, Selena's husband, Selena told Saldivar over the telephone that she was fired on March 10, the day after Abraham, Selena, and her sister, Suzette, had confronted Saldivar, claiming to have discovered evidence that she had stolen up to $30,000 from the fan club. But both Suzette and Celia Solis, one of Selena's boutique employees, testified that Selena had not made a final decision until March 30, the day before the shooting. Perez also testified that Saldivar was to continue working with Selena only to help set up the fashion ventures in Mexico, and that Saldivar had bank records Selena wanted back. There was also some gripping testimony about Selena and Saldivar's visit to Doctors Regional Medical Center the morning of the shooting. Saldivar had said that she had been raped earlier that week in Mexico, but after a medical examination proved inconclusive, Selena realized Saldivar was lying, according to two nurses at the hospital. The murder took place less than half an hour after the two left the hospital. Perhaps a fatal mistake was made in dragging out Saldivar's firing. Having most of the month of March to contemplate that her relationship was over with the person she described as the only friend I ever had was too much for Saldivar to take. As she told hostage negotiator Larry Young, I had a problem with her, and I just got to end it. The defense. If Douglas Tinker wasn't exactly a one-man dream team, the 61-year-old attorney had a long record of impressive acquittals. The criminal justice section of the State Bar of Texas had recognized him as the state's outstanding criminal defense lawyer for 1995. After Judge Westergren appointed Tinker to defend Yolanda Saldivar, Richard Racehorse Haynes said that she had lucked into $50 million worth of representation. At Tinker's request, Westergren appointed Arnold Garcia to assist him because Garcia spoke Spanish, as did Saldivar, and was a tireless investigator. Before the trial, many Houston lawyers had offered to assist Tinker in the high-profile case. Tinker took on Fred Hagens, a personal injury attorney and a former partner of super litigator John O'Quinn. This was Hagens' first criminal case, and he invested considerable sums of money for the experience. He offered the services of his co-counsel, Patricia Salm, hired jury consultant Robert Gordon, and staged a mock trial at an expense of more than $20,000. It was during the mock trial, with cameras filming the reactions of every juror, that Tinker first sensed his case might not be as strong as he had thought. Though one-third of the jury voted to acquit, not one of the test jurors seemed bothered by the actions of Paul Rivera, the officer who took Saldivar's confession, but didn't include her claim that the shooting was accidental. If the real jury didn't buy the bad cop theory, would they buy the accident? The prosecution. Carlos Valdez had never tried a felony case before he was elected district attorney for the 105th Judicial District 2 years ago. His presentations and examinations in court left room for improvement, but the boyish 41-year-old DA had the evidence, and he knew how to delegate. Valdez's chief prosecutor, Mark Skirka, a garrulous 36-year-old, tried the bulk of the case and ably demonstrated why he has prosecuted more murder cases in Nueces County than anyone else. During closing arguments in both the verdict and the sentencing phases, Skirka posted a picture of Selena in the jury box and repeatedly spoke to it, especially when he was referring to the defense's claim that the shooting was accidental, which he labeled hogwash. He called the defense strategy the squid defense, attacking Saldivar's defenders for putting out a black cloud of inky doubt to get away from the essence of the case. Elisa Sterling became part of the team when the case was assigned to Westergren's 214th District Court, where Sterling prosecutes cases. Between the three of them, the prosecution got the desired verdict by sticking to the indisputable evidence, by calling both friendly and hostile witnesses before the defense could, and by keeping the jurors focused on the victim. Selena screams, and her last steps and words immediately following the shooting were recounted by five motel employees, one of whom, Norma Martinez, said she had heard Saldivar shout, "Bitch!" at Selena. Their testimony, more than anything else, convicted Saldivar. The jury. It took 2 days to select the 12-person jury. Judge Westergren had decided that to keep things moving, he wouldn't seat alternates or sequester the jurors. Throughout the trial, the jury paid close attention, took notes, and showed little emotion, except for one blonde Anglo female who cried at the sight of the autopsy photographs and during the teary testimony of Frank Saldivar, the father of the accused. Up until the verdict, Tinker kept saying how much he liked this jury, in particular the three Anglo men sitting on the back row, one of whom was an ex-Marine. Tinker liked them so much he thought he could make his case without getting into the seamier aspects of the alleged split between Selena and her father. He liked them so much he called only three witnesses for the defense and recalled only two prosecution witnesses before resting, without asking the judge to consider a lesser charge. The guilty verdict was returned in less than 3 hours. The sentence of life in prison took 9 hours. Charles Arnold, who was one of the jurors Tinker liked so much, had held out for a 40-year sentence before giving in. The judge. The bow-tied Mike Westergren was the anti-Ito, the kind of judge who would have kept O.J. Simpson's dream team on a short leash. If nothing else, the unsuccessful candidate for the state Supreme Court was going to make the trial run on time and not let it get out of hand, despite pre-trial petitions from the Univision and Court TV networks. The 48-year-old judge ruled that cameras would not be allowed in his court. He showed a less serious side after the jury began deliberating punishment, when he visited with spectators in the gallery. As everyone began to relax, the din grew so loud that a bailiff had to shout, "Quiet in the courtroom!" Westergren, talking and laughing with two young lawyers, had sheepishly raised his hand and said, "I'm afraid it was me." Yolanda. Seeing the accused up close, it was hard to imagine that the tiny 4'9" woman could hurt a flea, much less pull the trigger of a murder weapon. Whenever a witness was asked to identify her, she stood up and tossed her head back with an air of pride. But when the 5 hours of hostage negotiation tapes were played in the court, a grueling listening experience, the eerie sound of her sobs and hysterical moans filling the room, Saldivar quietly began crying along with the tapes. It was a sad sight, but it humanized the cold-blooded murderer that the prosecution had portrayed. She broke down sobbing after the verdict was read, quietly saying she wanted to kill herself. While defense investigator Tina Valenzuela comforted her. Where's Larry? The most potentially explosive evidence was the recordings of conversations between Saldivar, sitting in the motel parking lot with a gun to her head, and the Corpus Christi Police Department's hostage negotiation team. Lead investigator Paul Rivera testified that he had been aware of the tapes in April. But they didn't surface until late August, after Tinker called Police Chief Henry Garrett and asked for them. Played in their entirety, they depicted Saldivar as distraught and panicky. Between her wails, Saldivar said over and over, "I didn't mean to do it," suggesting the shooting was an accident. She also blamed Abraham, saying, "He made me do it. He was out to get me. This man was so evil to me. My father even warned me about him. My father said I should get out before I get trapped." The special two-way phone line used by the hostage negotiation team was a flawed piece of technology. A portable phone would have allowed Saldivar a conference call with her mother in San Antonio, which she had asked for from the start. The two-way phone picked up the broadcast signal from the KSIX AM transmitter, located 100 yards from the motel parking lot, which is why the voice of Milo Hamilton calling a Rangers-Astros exhibition baseball game and the melody of the theme from MASH, "Suicide is Painless," could be heard when the tapes were played in court. It was through this interference that Yolanda heard a news report that Selena was dead, at which point she became even more hysterical. The tapes also reveal that hostage negotiators promised Saldivar that her mother and her lawyer, Richard Garza, would be waiting for her when she gave up. She wasn't, and he wasn't. One 30-minute tape consisted of little else but Yolanda repeating the mantra, "Where's Larry?" An appeal to bring negotiator Larry Young back on the line. The mantra was accompanied by a mysterious and extremely irritating electronic buzz. The bizarre audio conflagration inspired "Where's Larry?" t-shirts, which were hawked on the street the next day. The families. Both the Quintanilla and the Saldivar families came from humble Mexican-American roots and had survived and flourished by sticking close to their kin. The Quintanillas lived in 3 adjacent homes on Bloomington Street in the Molina neighborhood of Corpus Christi, the Saldivars in 4 houses and a trailer on 5 acres just beyond the southern city limits of San Antonio. While the Quintanillas showed signs of wealth, they wore expensive clothes and brought along their own family spokesman and publicist. The Saldivars were a true blue-collar family. The 56-year-old Abraham Quintanilla, a forceful presence, was a dominant figure at the trial, not only because the defense portrayed him as the one who drove Yolanda to buy the murder weapon, but also because he was Selena's father and her business manager. On many occasions since the shooting, he had shown himself to be a tough business manager, cutting deals and maximizing profit from all things Selena. He held countless press conferences to announce, among other things, the creation of the Selena Foundation, to introduce his new discovery, 12-year-old Jennifer Pena, who resembles a young Selena, and to reveal his role as executive producer of the movie being made about Selena's life, which filmmaker Gregory Nava was writing from the father's perspective. He became increasingly hostile to the media, though, after the value of Salinas' estate was published in the San Antonio Express News in September. Probate court documents revealed that her net worth was only $164,000, and that Chris Perez had given up his right to administrate the estate to Abraham. At the trial, Perez appeared thoroughly devastated by the loss of his wife, though the handsome ponytailed 26-year-old is a delicate figure by nature. Before the trial, he said that he wanted to continue playing guitar, focusing on rock music. He also answered critics who questioned the handling of the estate, saying, "I didn't have a lawyer just like Selena didn't have a lawyer. We didn't need a lawyer because this is family. And why should I worry about losing something? I have already lost what I always wanted. I would trade everything I had if I could have her back." Marcela Quintanilla, Selena's attractive mother, had said little publicly following the shooting in March. She was having just as much trouble as Perez coping with her daughter's death. When motel maintenance worker Trinidad Espinoza began recounting Selena's last moments, Marcela was overcome and had to leave. The next day, she was admitted to the coronary unit of St. Joseph's Hospital for overnight observation. Yolanda's mother, Juanita, was the only Saldivar to attend the entire trial, usually accompanied by one of her six other children and various nieces and nephews. Gray-haired and wrapped in a sweater, she was the living embodiment of the pobrecita abuelita, the poor little grandmother. On several occasions, she too had to be escorted out of the courtroom, overwhelmed with emotion. Yolanda's father, the diminutive Frank Saldivar, had recently retired after 40 years of balancing enchilada plates and glasses of iced tea as the head waiter at Yacala Restaurant in San Antonio. He spent his 69th birthday on the stand, fighting back tears and imploring jurors to have mercy on our baby girl. After sentencing, Juanita and Frank crossed the rail and hugged and kissed Yolanda goodbye. The street. Every day, Selena fans gathered outside the courthouse and made their feelings known by holding signs, wearing shirts, or shouting chants such as "Justicia," or "Cien años." As the trial neared conclusion, their numbers swelled, and the mood took on a vindictive streak, evidenced by a "Hang the Witch" placard, posters that depicted Saldivar in handcuffs standing in the middle of a Target with the words "La Marrana," the sow, written underneath, and a "Kill Yolanda" message painted in white shoe polish on the windshield of a Toyota. But imagination was at work, too. One sign paraphrased a line from the new crossover country hit of Selena's old label mate and duet partner Emilio Navera. "There can never be enough justice for Selena, but it's a damn good start." The celebrations around the courthouse following the guilty verdict and the sentence were marked by the strange sight of tears on the faces of many fans, especially older women. For them, Selena had already evolved from a pop star into an icon of grief. The media. There were more than 200 media credentials issued for the trial, with almost as many Spanish-language media as English-language media. The most thorough TV coverage came from the two Spanish-language networks, Univision and Telemundo, both of which aired at least 90 minutes' worth of coverage daily. Univision's Marie Celeste Arradas, the doe-eyed, henna-haired anchor of Primer Impacto, a news program seen throughout the United States and in 15 foreign countries, was the trial's undisputed media star, judging from the fans' wolf whistles and the way they crowded her on the street. Her program had the most knowledgeable courtroom analyst, former Corpus State District Judge Jorge Rangel, who knew Texas law and the players in the trial. The O.J. Effect. As murder trials go, The one in Houston had little to do with the O.J. Simpson trial in Los Angeles, other than it involved homicide and a celebrity. Nevertheless, comparisons were frequently made. Before the trial, Abraham Quintanilla observed that after the O.J. verdict, anything was possible. Once the trial began, the fear spread through barrios in Texas that Saldivar might get off as a result of police officer Paul Rivera's questionable handling of the confession. Salinas' own Mark Furman was going to mess everything up. The verdict shored up trust in a legal system that has come under increasingly close and critical scrutiny. It proved to Texas's largest minority group that the criminal justice system, flawed as it may be, really does work. Following the trial, the League of United Latin American Citizens announced a campaign to urge Hispanics to seek jury duty. Waiting for the jury. While the jury deliberated the sentence, the mood in the courtroom turned informal and almost jovial. Sheriff's deputies ceased patting down media when they reentered the courtroom. A bailiff approached Yolanda Saldivar and whipped out a court pass, asking her to sign it. Pretty soon, members of the press were slipping their passes to Arnold Garcia for Saldivar to sign. Westergren and Valdez were signing autographs, too. The Saldivar family sought out the autographs of several reporters. Tinker posed for sketch artists and quipped, "If the jury never comes back, it would be fine with me." Two spectators dozed off. So briefly did Abraham Quintanilla, sitting alone in the family seating section. This was hardly the stuff of a trial of the century. When the sentence of life in prison was returned, Carlos Valdez saluted the jury. Douglas Tinker announced that he would appeal. Following the final press conference, the same man who was fretting about being followed by angry Selena fans was still being hounded. But the fans didn't want Tinker's head. They wanted his autograph. The future. In addition to the Selena movie, her band's farewell tour next spring, and other Selena memorial projects, Abraham Quintanilla has been building a roster of young talent for his custom label distributed by Capital EMI. A 900 number has been set up for fans to telephone condolences to the family for $3.99 per call. Selena's sister, Suzette, handles the boutiques and Selena merchandising. Selena's brother, A.B. Quintanilla III, has been busy producing acts in the recording studio and writing. His composition, Estúpido Romántico, co-written with former Selena backup singer and popular solo act, Pete Astudillo, was a big hit for the Tejano supergroup Maz, and he recently composed a theme song for a Mexican soap opera. He has just moved his wife, Benji, and their two children to a palatial new home west of Corpus. Chris Perez is looking for a new place, too. The three Quintanilla homes on Bloomington Street will soon be an empty nest. Family matters. Back inside the friendly, dimly lit confines of Buster's Drinkery, 2 hours after the jury had returned its verdict, the conversation shifted from law to family. Tinker had spent the previous weekend camping out in the woods of Alabama. "My son attends boarding school there, and it was parents' weekend. I haven't seen him in several months," he said. Garcia spoke lovingly of his son, Javier, a metal sculptor. "They agree that no matter how hard you try, you can never tell how your kids will turn out." Abraham and Marcela Quintanilla loved their daughter and had tried to protect her. Frank and Juanita Saldivar loved their daughter, too. And they all wound up in a court of law in Houston, where 12 strangers passed judgment on why everything turned out so badly.
This is Michael. I'll be reading articles that are shorter articles that are related to Selena. Texas Monthly Music, tuned out. Why the Tejano music industry hasn't recovered the death of Selena. By Joe Nick Patowski. Published May 2000. Is Tejano dead? That question has been kicked around so often since 1995 when Selena died tragically. One might actually start believing that the music of assimilation has assimilated itself into extinction, and justifiably so. No other Tejano artist has come close to achieving her success. Selena Quintanilla Perez was the total package. She was talented, she was smart, she was attractive, and she was a star destined for greater stardom. Even 5 years after her murder, she's still the biggest thing in Tejano. Sales of her albums remain strong, with two new compilations recently appearing on the Billboard 200 national album charts, a level that no Tejano act has ever reached since her passing. In March, the biggest buzz at the Tejano Music Awards in San Antonio was the new musical based on Selena's life, which was kicking off a Texas tour before heading to Broadway. There is no question that, had she lived, Selena would be at the forefront of the Latin music explosion that has raised the profiles of Ricky Martin, Marc Anthony, Enrique Iglesias, and Christina Aguilera, a movement in which the absence of any Tejano act is glaring. Emilio's prominence has declined as traditionalists like Bobby Pulido and Michael Salgado have grown more popular. He has also suffered from well-publicized personal problems. La Mafia, which had rivaled Selena in sales, was torn apart by a lawsuit filed by departing co-founder Leonard Gonzalez and has only recently got back on its feet with a three-record deal with the Los Angeles-based label Fonovisa. Maz split in two, with singer Joe Lopez forming La Nueva Imagine de Maz and creative director Jimmy Gonzalez putting together the original Maz. But even with Selena's contemporary struggling, does that mean Tejano is dead? If it's dead, I'm out of a job, sighs Johnny Ramirez as he picks at his steak at an upscale restaurant near the San Antonio airport. As the morning host of KXTN FM Tejano 107.5, Ramirez is literally the voice of the music in the capital city of Tejano. Both he and his drive time partner, J.D. Gonzalez, say that Tejano appears to be undergoing an identity crisis, but they wonder whether it's a reality or a matter of perception. Ramirez acknowledges that KXTN is no longer the city's top-rated station, as it was during the mid-90s. But he points out that it is among the three most listened to stations in San Antonio, that its audience numbers are higher than ever, and that the cost of a one-minute advertisement on Tejano 107.5 is higher than at any other frequency in the city. Since the station went on the internet at the beginning of the year, emails from listeners as far away as Guam have poured in. We've got our own sound, explains Gonzalez. Our market is so specific. We're not a mainstream genre. Ramirez agrees. It's not a sound per se. It's a lifestyle. We love rock and roll, blues, jazz, country. We're hard to pin down. Ramirez and Gonzalez are typical of the Tejano listener. Both are under 40, sophisticated, and bilingual, and they're both trying to make sense of Tejano's latest trend, a return to the rural ranchera sound that Tejano sought to separate itself from when it emerged in the 50s and 60s. It's all about roots, and it's turning the business upside down. Consider Los Palominos, a Grammy-winning group from Uvalde that takes more of a traditional, almost rural tact. The band dresses in matching Western duds, sings cowboy-style ballads, and uses the accordion as the lead instrument. Like Intocable and Michael Salgado, it is expanding its fan base in not into the English language general market, as it's called, but into Monterrey and other areas of northern Mexico, where Tejano and regional Mexican are almost the same. But the crossover stops there. Spanish radio in Los Angeles and Chicago is still influenced by what's selling in the interior of Mexico, where grupos like Los Tigres del Norte and Bronco rule, not by what's selling in northern Mexico and South Texas, which the rest of the music industry still considers the boonies. Mondo Leichenberger Jr., the Houston-based producer of La Mafia and Los Palominos, saw the shift coming 10 years ago. As the major record labels were locking up all the big Tejano acts with overly generous contracts, he found Los Pals playing a rawer kind of Tejano, one that was too rootsy for what was being played on the radio, but one that would come to influence other musicians, such as singer Michael Salgado. Salgado, a raspy-voiced romancero, emulates the vocal gymnastics of Cornelio Reyna, who played with the great Ramon Ayala, the man who started a retro root sound long before it was cool. What's happening now is everything that's being played has a Ramon Ayala sound, says Leichenberger. In that respect, Tejano has exploded, but not in the way Tejano radio anticipated. In other words, the regional sound has become more insular, which has forced those acts seeking the Latin mainstream to adjust. La Mafia, for example, hires songwriters from Mexico and Argentina to overcome the regional and cultural differences. It's a matter of style, Leichenberger says. Until our Spanish gets more refined, we're at a disadvantage when competing against Luis Miguel or Marc Anthony, he says. Tejano, the vehicle we once thought would carry us into the mainstream, is more limited now. Selena and La Mafia were able to find that middle ground between appealing to Tejano radio in Texas and finding a fan base outside Texas. The radio makes the contrast clear. Houston's leading Spanish language station, KLTN-FM, Estereo Latina 102.9, is ranked number one in the general market, playing more of a pan-Latin selection of music, similar to what listeners in Chicago or Los Angeles hear. A similar station is making inroads in San Antonio. For Tejano radio formats to survive, Leichenberger believes they need to integrate more Latin artists along the lines of Ricky Martin, Jennifer Lopez, and Enrique Iglesias. Tejano has felt threatened by these broader formats because they're getting a bigger and bigger share of the audience. I think if they played them along with classic Selena, Ram Herrera, Jay Perez, and Maz, they'd do better. But that doesn't mean that Tejano acts can't cross over into the mainstream. Look no further than Selena's intimates to understand that. Her brother, A.B. Quintanilla, has enjoyed considerable success with his Cumbia Kings by rendering cumbias into pop confections. His Amor, Familia y Respeto has sold approximately 1 million copies. But Quintanilla's most interesting material are two English language cuts, Together and You Don't Love Me, which are both straight out of the Backstreet Boys books of sweet harmonies. Meanwhile, Selena's husband, Chris Perez, has reached for a broader audience by ditching the Tejano sound altogether in favor of rock en español. Still, the artists aren't necessarily the ones who are dictating the shift. Consolidation of the music industry, done in the name of marketing and efficiency, has compounded the separation. Given Tejano's localized appeal, the Latin music industry would prefer not having to contemplate the genre at all, which is marked by its many stylistic quirks. I have this belief that the big labels would rather get rid of the regional sound, says Leichenberger. They'd rather market music they understand instead of hiring middlemen who understand Tejano. For every Marc Anthony who sells 60,000 copies, it's one more blow to the Tejano sound. Look who's appearing at the Tejano Awards show and see where the priorities are. 5 years ago, it was second-generation Tejano act Bobby Pulido. Now all the attention is going to mainstream Latin pop. The vacuum created by the majors has been filled by Texas-based independent record labels and mom-and-pop record stores, both of which can respond more quickly to the changing tastes of the Tejano audience. That explains the success of new labels such as Luxor, Tejas, and Chipinacay, and the resurgence of established ones, like Freddie and Joey International. Similarly, several old guard acts are enjoying renewed attention. Notably, vocalists Ram Herrera, Jay Perez, and Sherry Larez, who has breathed fire into a traditional ballad called Volver Volver. Most eyes and ears are on Alida Reyna, the leader of Alida y Avante. The 23-year-old Valley girl from Mercedes shares Selena's natural beauty and exhibits flashes of her vocal power. But even after carrying home 4 trophies from this year's Tejano Music Awards, she's still cultivating a style that will separate her from the pack. There will never be another Selena, but Alida just may have the right stuff to match her firepower and become a star recognized by the rest of the Latin music world. Whether the industry can accommodate her aspirations is the musical question that has yet to be answered.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 82 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome one and all to the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing jazz and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. I hope you're all doing well. Fun show planned for you today as I take a look at the history of gold and silver records, as well as both the history of top songs on the Your Hit Parade and Billboard charts. Everything we will discuss will reflect the early days of those rating systems, in conjunction, of course, with our mission to keep the music of the 1930s and 40s alive. But first, I play Fanfare for a Cheerful Occasion, written in 1930. Why a fanfare? And why is it cheerful? Because I present you with one of my infrequent trivia quizzes where I reach into my premium bin. And I'm going to give away two make-believe ballroom radio music note and microphone gold lapel pins. I'm going to play a record and ask you who the singer is. But before I play that record, I just want to make sure I keyed it up in my playlist as an MP3. Yes, I have. You don't have to name the song or the year of the song. You just have to give me the name of the vocalist. I'll give you one clue, and that was that he was a beloved figure for many decades, but he was not necessarily known primarily as a singer. After I play the mystery record with the mystery singer, I'll let you know how to send me the correct answer. Who was he?
I want to shout a poem about how I dream of that gleam in your eye. I want to shout, but all that comes out is my. I want to sing of flowers in spring, but oh dear, when you're near, I just die. I want to sing and can't sing a thing, but my. I should say, oh, how lovely. I should say, ah, how sweet. I could have Shakespeare at the tip of my tongue, but every time we meet, I look at you, and what do? I get weak, I can't speak, I just sigh. And though I try, the best I can sigh is my. But so shy, you're sort of sweet the way you repeat my. You're kind of smart the way you're capturing my heart with that line, you define sweetie pie. You're sort of smart to make a fine art of my. I could say how intriguing, or I could say how pretty. I could have Webster in the palm of my hand, but every time we meet, dead pigeon, you don't do bad. In fact, I might add, you're my type, time's right, sugar pie. Why, Josephine, that's just what I mean by my.
Okay, who was that vocalist? The contest is only open to those listening to the program from May 3rd to May 8th, 2021. Many of our listeners don't hear the programs in sequence on their community of public radio stations for internal programming reasons, which I fully understand. But if you do hear it first run, you can enter. Again, only those listening between May 3rd, May 8th, 2021 are eligible. If you know or think you know who the mystery singer is, drop me an email, at jeff@makebelieveballroomradio.com. That's jeff@makebelieveballroomradio.com. And here in the Crystal Studio, we will draw two correct answers and send those two winners one of our swell Make-Believe Ballroom Music Note and Microphone Gold Lapel Pens.